All right, well, it's an honor to be the last speaker, and I see there's still plenty of people around. This will not be quite so as algebraic or geometric as the previous talk, but it will lead into some questions of algebraic geometry. We were led into this by a rather natural sequence of events, and so let me give you a little bit of history of some of the work that Richard Beals and Jacek and myself have been working on. We originally started looking at the Kamasa-Hom equation, and in particular the periodic picons. There was an interesting scattering problem, or an inverse scattering problem associated with that, and I had a long conversation with both Kamasa and Holm at Ober-Volfach a few years ago, and they got us into this problem. And so we started thinking about how you would solve that inverse problem. And we were led to some rather interesting results. And let me try to give you the background, because before I talk about the periodic picons and the Calogero-Francois equations, I want to talk about the events leading up to that that situation. So the Kamasa-Hom flows, we heard about this in the previous talk. This is the isospectral operator for these flows. This was discovered by Kamasa and Holm in connection with this equation down here. This is the Kamasa-Hom equation that they discovered. I might say rediscovered, because it had been discovered already by Fuchs Steiner and Foucas by purely algebraic methods, whereas Kamasa and Holm approached it from a physical basis and in an approximation in water waves, and this is the equation that they arrived at. So this was actually their, their starting point was with the Hamiltonian structure for water waves and a certain approximation. And at any rate, they arrived at this equation with this lax pair. This is the isospectral operator, and here's the operator A. And when you work it out, you get somewhat a little different than the type of lax equations that you're used to in KdV, because you get this additional term here. So you get L dot is not simply the bracket of L with A, but it's the bracket of L with A with plus this perturbation term, which really has no major effect on the calculations. It just well, it's still okay. That's a good question. Okay, so let's go to the next. We'll get there. It might take me a couple slides, but I'll explain what we mean by isospectral. As I said, the equation was originally discovered by Fuchs Steiner by a purely Lie algebraic development. He derived a lot of equations this way, a lot of integrable equations, and that was one of them that he obtained. Kamasa and Holm used a more physical argument. There's some interesting questions surrounding that derivation, and Russell Johnson looked at this more recently, the derivation of the Kamasa-Holm equation for the chord of vague degrees and related models. And also it's recently come up as a model for dispersive, nonlinear dispersive waves in elasticity. So I just mentioned those two references. If we go back to that previous slide, notice that the lax equation leads to these coupled equations. There are two parameters. There's an M that shows up in the isospectral operator, and there's a U that shows up in the operator A, and they're connected by this equation. And the Kamasa-Holm equation itself is obtained by eliminating M and just writing down the equation U. Then it's third order in X, and you notice you've got this term U, UX, XX. We found it a little more convenient to write the equation as a system, especially when you're dealing with the types of picons that they found, because the solutions that they find are not differentiable at the peaks. So then you have to make sense of what do you mean by the third order derivative? You're going to get the derivative of the delta function there. But you can make sense of that system in this form, the singularities in this form. So the relationship U and M are related by a differential equation, and if you invert that differential equation, you can write U as a function of as a functional on M, a nonlinear functional on M, and this function G is just the Green's function for this operator that shows up in that that differential relationship. Now, Kamasa and Holm proposed a kind of an analog of the Molde-Soliton solutions of KdV. They found a single, equation like this, a constant m and this sort of thing for a traveling wave, and they proposed superpositions of these things. So they proposed a solution that looked something like this, and a solution of that type will arise if you take for m a summation of m sub j of t delta of x minus xj. So if m is taken as a discrete measure, this is the form you'll get for u. And it turns out that there's a Hamiltonian associated with this reduction, and I'll come to that in a minute. But these solutions were called the Mollet-Picon solutions due to the peak in the solution. You see, you get a peak, say here, when x is equal to x sub j. It kind of comes up to a sharp peak because of that absolute value there. So here's the Hamiltonian that they wrote down. H of x sub j, m sub j is a quadratic in m and the m's, and then g is just the Green's function for that relationship between m and u. And they found explicit solutions for systems of two picons, and conjectured, and they were correct, that this Hamiltonian system was completely integrable. So now let's go to John's question. What do we mean by isospectral for this slightly different form of the Lax equations? We can construct wave functions of the solution that satisfies wave functions of the differential equation L of lambda phi equals zero. And especially if we're looking at functions at M with compact support, then off the support of M, the equation is just d squared minus 1 equals zero, d squared minus 1 phi equals zero. So out at infinity, these solutions, I wrote asymptotic. It's, if M has compact support, there will be a function phi naught that looks like e to the x as x goes to minus infinity. And there will be another one that that's exactly e to the minus x as x goes to plus infinity. So we start out with, say, phi naught, and we look at its asymptotics as plus infinity. So this is kind of the scattering data. And we'll expand it at plus infinity. We'll say it looks like b of t lambda e to the x plus c of t lambda e to the minus x. And again, in the Picon case, I could actually write equality here. These asymptotic relations are under the assumption that m decays relatively rapidly. Okay, if you repeat the usual arguments that you're used to with KdV, you'll find that by the so phi satisfies two equations. One is the spectral equation, the differential, the d squared minus lambda m minus 1 phi naught equals 0, and then it satisfies a time-dependent equation. And if you use the time evolution of phi naught, you find that those coefficients at plus infinity look like this. dB by dt is 0, b dot is 0, which is basically expressing the isospectrality, as you'll see in a minute. And then dc by dt is minus 2c over lambda. And the c's here, if you set b equal to 0, you get that the function is exponentially decaying at both plus and minus infinity. B is the coefficient of the e to the x at plus infinity. So if b is 0, then this wave function is decaying at both plus infinity and minus infinity, and those are the eigenfunctions. And since b is 0, if you look for a value lambda sub nu for which b of lambda sub nu equals 0, then that will be invariant. So the lambda nu, those eigenvalues, will be invariant under the flow. And that's what we mean by isospectrality. In this case, the spectrum is discrete. Well, now that's the point. It appears it's a coefficient of m. So in KdV, the energy is independent of q, but now it's multiplying m. So that's a fundamental difference between the spectral problem for Kamasa-Holm and the spectral problem for KdV. They're quite different in nature. There is a Liouville transformation that takes it to a Schrodinger operator, but for various reasons, I don't think that's the way to approach the problem. That would do it. But the inversion of that is highly nonlinear. Yeah. Or when m changes sign. Yeah. Right. Right. Which are exactly what you get with these anti-Picons. So we proceeded off in a different direction. So the C's then satisfy, the C's turn out to be the coupling coefficients between this wave function normalized at minus infinity and the other one normalized at plus infinity. And then from this equation, you get the evolution, the time evolution of the scattering data. They're actually real. They are real. Yeah. If M is real, they're real. Let's see. It's not behaving. Let's try this one. Oops. Now what do I do? There we go. So here's a picture of, so we were just talking about positive and negative values of M, and this is the interesting thing about this problem is when M changes sign, a lot of these, a lot of the transformations that you make depend on positive M. The one we're going to use does not require M to be positive. And then you get these, a combination of a picon and an antipicon. So in this sequence, you see the picon is the positive one, has a positive M, the antipicon has a negative M, and these things come in opposite directions. So the picon moves to the right, so you see in this sequence, the picon has moved to the right, and the antipicon has moved to the left. Over the sequence of things. That's right. So in this, we could have made them the same. Okay. So here, when they come together, well, this is the actual collision time. The one of them just completely absorbs the other. When they're actually the same for this instant of the collision, the solution profile looks like it's identically zero. Which means if you took that as initial data and started it out. Well, it doesn't say zero, so here's a kind of a non-uniqueness example for this thing. So it's not really zero. It's actually, you have to look at it in the sense of distributions to make sense of that. This is U. M actually goes off to infinity, at least when they're both the same. But then you see you have this picon and antipicon, and the M1 is going to, there are two M's, so M1 is going off to plus infinity, M2 is going off to minus infinity, but at the same time, there's a cancellation. It's a rather intricate singularity. Right, right. And now I have this thing down here that's to remind me that we actually made a movie in MATLAB, using some of the explicit formulas that we had. Now let's see if this shows up. Can you see? Oh, yeah, it shows up. So here's two picons and an antipicon. And here you see the interaction of them. This is based on explicit solutions that we have for these things. And there you see the interaction. There's phase shifts exactly as there is for KdV. You get the phase shifts. I'll come to a little bit more of that information in a minute. Okay, anybody want to see the movie again? No? Okay. So, oops. All right. So now we'll go to the next one. I guess I don't have anything down on the transparencies, but let me just give you a kind of a history of what happened here. I guess I didn't put that down in here. What we did was to transform the solution to an acoustic scattering problem. I'm surprised I didn't put this down. I guess I... All sorts of... So I'm not going to tell you a lot about the... I might not tell you anything about it. It won't go forward. It just doesn't want to go forward, does it? All right. Well, now we got to go way back. Oops. I blew it. Now I can't do anything. I'm going to close. I'm sorry about this. This is the problems with technology. I've never seen it do this sort of thing. This is Windows, right? That explains it. All right. So I guess, so let me just explain explain some things. I don't have it down on the transparencies. But what we did in solving the, to solve the PCON problem, to get those explicit formulas, we made what's known as a Liouville transformation, a very special kind of a Liouville transformation. So here is the original equation, and this is on the line, minus infinity less than x less than infinity. And instead of transforming this to the to the Schrodinger equation, we used what's called a Liouville transformation. We introduced a new parameter, y equals the hyperbolic tangent of x, and you get minus 1 is less than y is less than 1. And so let me go over to this side, and let me just write down what that isospectral problem is. So when you do that, and you make a change in the p's, you get this equation, where phi of minus 1 lambda is 0, and phi of 1 and lambda is 0. That's the eigenvalue problem. So instead of having the d squared, instead of getting rid of the lambda, we got rid of the minus 1. Okay? And this is called an acoustic scattering problem. It's quite different from the Schrodinger problem, because the spectral parameter lambda occurs in front of the M. And we looked specifically at these multi-PCON cases where some M, now I pulled M down to the interval, M is the summation J equals 1 to N, M sub J delta of Y minus Y sub J. And our picture is we have a finite string with these mass points distributed between minus 1 to 1. And that's that finite string problem, that spectral problem, had been looked at by Krein in the 1950s. And it's connected with some very deep results in classical analysis. Namely, it's connected with the Stieltjes solution of the classical moment problem. So if you write down you can compute the Weyl function for this problem. It's a discrete problem. It's a finite dimensional problem. You can compute the Weyl function for that problem. You can expand the Weyl function. It's a rational function. It has a finite number of poles, and you can expand it in one of two forms. Either you can do a principal parts expansion, in other words, summation of cj over lambda minus lambda j, and in that form, you use the spectral data. You use the lambda j's, the eigenvalues of the problem, and the cj's with the coupling coefficients. And you know how that data evolves. Then there's a second way you can write that down. You can write it down as a continued fraction. And when you write that Weyl function down as a continued fraction, you write it down in terms of the LJs, which are the gaps between YJ and YJ minus 1, and the MJs. So there are two different ways to write that, to represent that Weyl function. One is the principal parts expansion, which uses the spectral data, and one is a continued fraction expansion, which uses the string data. And anyway, Stieltjes solved the inverse problem. He showed how to go from the principal parts expansion to writing down these coefficients, the string data. So Stieltjes's classical solution of and that was related to the solution of the moment problem. So Stieltjes's classical solution of the moment problem gives you explicit formulas for writing down the data for the strings, the LJs and the MJs, in terms of the scattering data. We know how the scattering data evolves from the lax pair. In other words, the lambda J's are the lambda sub nu's are constant, and the C nu's evolve linearly. So we can write down the Weyl function explicitly. Then we can use Stieltjes's formulas to write down explicit formulas for the LJs and GJs. And those, incidentally, I believe are actually the tau functions for this problem. And then we get explicit solutions, and that's what we use to make this little movie. So that's where things stood. And then various people asked us questions. For example, they asked us, well, What's the difference between these multi-Picon solutions and, say, the finite Jacobi lattice, the finite total lattice? It turns out there's a connection there, and you can relate the Picon flows, these multi-Picon flows, to the flows of Jacobi matrices. You can make an exact identification. And another question that was asked, first by Colagio and then by Francoise, was the following. Colagio wrote down a Hamiltonian of this form, clearly motivated by the work of Camassa and Holm, and he discovered, so for a general F, and he discovered that this Hamiltonian system was completely integrable if F has the form lambda plus mu cosine nu x. And then subsequently, he and Francoise showed that you could actually show that this thing was completely integrable, you got complete integrability, for a somewhat more general class of Fs. F equals lambda plus mu cosine nu x plus mu prime sine nu times the absolute value of x, and then this degenerate case. And so they asked us, do these things have anything to do with the multi-Picon solutions? Can you find explicit solutions of these things? So that was the question that we were trying to answer. And so what happened was the following. We discovered the following things. So let me list these things, and then I'll go through some of the details. So what we found was that the Colagio-Francois flows are finite dimensional reduction of a family of equations associated with this operator, the minus the one was changed to nu squared. The functions f are the Green's function for the equation 4 nu squared d minus d cubed operating on u equals dm. That should be a lowercase m there. So you remember, for the multi-Picon solutions, or for the Camassa-Holm equation, I had an m in the isospectral operator, had an m in the L, and I had a u in the time evolution. So there's a connection between those two things, namely a differential equation. It's actually a third-order equation. I'd done one integration before, but it's a third-order equation. And so if you write down the Green's function for that third-order equation and look at the... Okay, now I have to be a little careful, because to do the Camassa-Holm equation, the solutions of the Camassa-Holm equation, we took the Green's functions that went to zero. The natural thing to do, you just take the decaying exponentials. But you could write down, you could always add on a solution of the homogeneous equation, right? The Green's function is, the fundamental solution is only uniquely determined up to a solution of the homogeneous equation. So if you allow things to grow at infinity, then you'll get things that look like this. And we haven't said anything yet about what nu is. If nu is imaginary, then you'll get oscillatory behavior, and you'll get those things that Colagio and Francoise got. If nu is real, then you'll get exponentially growing and decaying solutions. And there's an additional constant gamma that comes out of the fact that that's a third-order equation. You can do one integration. This was the degenerate case that Colagio and Francoise came up with, and we'd already looked at that case. That case, nu equals zero, corresponds to what's known as the Hunter-Saxton flow for the Camassa-Holm equation. If you write down d squared minus lambda m minus 1, or minus nu squared, and then take nu going to 0, you get also an integrable system. It's an isospectral deformation. So the case nu equals 0 corresponds to the Hunter-Saxton flow. And then we tried to analyze the more general case with the Colagio-Francois flows. And we had quite a bit of difficulty because we couldn't seem to show that there was any, we couldn't find an isospectral problem for it. And Jacek finally said, you know, I think this thing has something to do with periodic tota. It looks like a periodic problem. And indeed, the Colagio-Francois flows, I will say, are similar, and I'll show you what I mean in a minute, similar mathematically to the periodic Picons for the Camassa-Holm equation. So I'm going to look at the first look at the periodic flows, which you can kind of see very concretely, and then look at the Colagio-Francois flows, which are a little more general. There's a Riemann surface, which is invariant under the flow. So instead of looking for an isospectral problem, we look for a spectral curve, an invariant curve. And the flow is linearized by the Abel map on a hyperelliptic curve, just as in periodic KdV. For d particles, the associated invariant curve is hyperelliptic of genus d minus 1. For d equals 2, the invariant curve is elliptic, and that's the case that I'll discuss here. So let's talk about periodic Picons. So once you realize that you should be looking at something like a periodic case, you try the periodic PCON. So so the M for periodic PCONs just looks like this, and then you sum from N equals minus infinity to infinity. You've just taken all the particles within a window from that should be a minus 1 to 1, and then you just translate them. So you have an infinite number of particles in a lattice. And then U looks like this, and G now is this periodized Green's function. And so now let's talk about the wave functions. We'll look at the wave. Now the wave functions, we haven't gone down to the we haven't made this Liouville transformation. We did all this up on the level of the line. Maybe we should actually take it down to the string, minus 1 to 1. But anyway, we did this on the line. So where the mass is 0, where m is 0, you're just solving d squared minus 1 phi equals 0. So you get linear combinations of e to the x and e to the minus x. And in each interval, if you look at one of these, if you look at the line with these various points, in each one of these intervals, you get a e to the x plus b e to the minus x. And then when you jump across this point, your aj and your bj change. So basically what you have to do is compute the transitions of aj and bj across one of those jumps, and that just amounts to integrating those differential equations, and you can compute the jumps. And here's the jump relation. Aj plus 1, bj plus 1 is this matrix tj times this, and tj is this matrix. And then you get a monodromy matrix if you put all these things together. You go across the whole layer. And that's basically what we're going to be doing, is looking at the associated monodromy matrix. There's one more issue, and that is we're using these basis functions, e to the x and e to the minus x, as a basis for a periodic function. So we have to kind of renormalize the function. We have to make a transition matrix between the two bases as you go across the layer. And that matrix amounts to this thing, e 0, 0, e to the minus 1. And so I'm going to define a matrix psi of lambda is that monodromy matrix E of lambda times E, and we're going to think of that as a kind of a Floquet matrix. So the idea to deal with the Calandre-Francoise flows is not to deal with the isospectral operator L, but to deal with this monodromy matrix, this essentially Floquet matrix psi of lambda. That's the key object here. And it's similar in when you do periodic KdV. Instead of dealing with the spectrum of the Schrodinger operator, you deal with the spectrum of the monodromy matrix. And so many things are similar. The determinant of psi of lambda is identically 1. That's easy. This determinant is 1. All those transition matrices had determinant 1. Psi of lambda is a polynomial of degree d in lambda. That's because we're just making d jumps. And every time you make a jump, you introduce a power of lambda. Then you can derive an equation. P dot is a hat p, the bracket of a hat and p. I won't write down a hat for you, but you see this is a kind of a lax equation for the that should not be p. That should be psi. That should be psi dot is a the bracket of a hat and psi, and therefore p of lambda, which is the trace of psi, is an invariant. So the trace of psi of lambda is an invariant under the Kamasa-Holm flow, under the periodic Kamasa-Holm flow. If you do these calculations, you see that phi of lambda looks like this. The initial term is 1, then you've got a lambda over 2, and then you've got these quantities that show up. M is the sum of the mj's. That's an invariant of the motion. And then the m plus and m minus take this form. The off-diagonal terms take this form. Okay, now when you do, say, periodic KdV, the picture changes from looking at eigenvalues of the operator to eigenvalues of the Floquet matrix. And the particular eigenvalues that are important are the eigenvalues 1 and, 1 and minus 1. Those correspond to the periodic and antiperiodic spectra. And those are the invariants, those are the isospectral quantities for this flow, for these flows. So the periodic and antiperiodic boundary, the corresponding boundary conditions are phi of that should be phi of minus 1 in lambda, and this is phi of 1 in lambda. I'm just doing this on the line. I'm not doing it on the string from minus 1 to 1. So we're just looking at a period going from 0 to 1. We're putting all the particles in there. And so the periodic boundary conditions are phi of 0 lambda equals phi of 1 lambda, and also the derivatives match. Then in periodic KdV, there's something called the auxiliary spectrum, which for the periodic KdV are the Dirichlet boundary conditions. So if you set phi equal to zero at the endpoints, those are the so-called auxiliary boundary conditions. And I guess you actually use Dirichlet boundary conditions and Neumann boundary conditions, the auxiliary spectra. In this case, the auxiliary boundary conditions turn out to be d plus or minus 1 phi of 0 lambda is d plus or minus 1, and phi of 1 lambda is 0. So that's the auxiliary spectrum for this. And I'll explain where this comes from in a minute. So the periodic and antiperiodic spectrum are those lambda nus for which phi of lambda unequal to 0 satisfies the periodic or antiperiodic boundary conditions. Equivalently, psi of lambda has the eigenvalue plus or minus 1. So you can phrase those either in terms of the spectrum of psi or the wave functions phi, the boundary conditions of phi. The periodic and antiperiodic spectra are real, non-zero zeros of p of lambda minus or plus 2, respectively. I'll show you that why that is in the next slide. And so they're constants of the motion. P of lambda, remember, is a constant that is invariant. And so it's the zeros of this expression are invariant. Out of the flow. A real. Yeah, they're real, they're non-zero, and they're zeros of this. See, comma. Yeah, okay. Right. Well, if they were non-zero zeros, then I wouldn't have had the comma there. Okay. Anyway, we can discuss this afterwards. Okay. Now, the auxiliary spectrum are the roots of psi 2, 1, and psi 1, 2, the off-diagonal entries. For periodic KdV, the auxiliary spectrum are the zeros of the off-diagonal entries of the monodrome of the Floquet matrix, and that's what gives you, I think, the Dirichlet and the Neumann boundary conditions. But here, if you go into what that means in terms of the wave functions, you see the roots of these things give you these auxiliary boundary conditions. Okay. So here's a theorem, and this theorem is specific to the periodic Picon case, but it's analogous to a corresponding theorem for KdV, for periodic KdV. So p squared minus 4 has 2d roots. P is degree d, so p squared has degree 2d, and it has 2d real roots, lambda 1 through lambda 2d, and these are the periodic and antiperiodic spectra. Let's look down here at this picture. This is the case for d equals 2, so p of lambda is a quadratic, and so the roots of p squared minus 4 are either the roots of p equals 2 or p equals minus 2. And so lambda 1 is a periodic point, lambda 2 is antiperiodic, lambda 3 is antiperiodic, and lambda 4 is periodic. So maybe the picture is easier to understand than the description. And then there's these auxiliary spectra, and they lie in this region here. The whole thing is connected with a Riemann surface, which I'll explain in a minute, and the slits on the Riemann surface is a double covering of the complex plane, and it's slit along here and along here, so along lambda 1 to lambda 2 and lambda 3 to lambda 4. So what we were interested in were the eigenvalues of psi of lambda, and if you just write down the eigenvalue property, the characteristic equation for the eigenvalues of psi, you'll get mu squared minus p of lambda mu plus 1 equals 0. P of lambda is an invariant, so these eigenvalues are going to be invariant under the flow. And when you solve this quadratic equation for mu, you get mu of lambda in z is p of lambda, I've written plus z, and z is plus or minus this. So this thing really lives on the Riemann surface. It has two values, an upper and a lower value. And it lives on this Riemann surface, z squared equals p squared of lambda minus 4. That's the Riemann surface for this curve. That's the invariant curve, the invariant Riemann surface for these flows. Okay. And then, as I say, you cut the Riemann sphere along these intervals in the plane. Okay. So So now let's talk about the evolution of the scattering data. The periodic spectra give us deconstants of integration, actually, you could look at it this way. You've got periodic spectra. You've got deep values there. You've got antiperiodic spectra. There's two deep values, but those are all constants. You need to choose. You could take those as the invariance of the motion. You could take those as your action variables. And then you have d action variables. You need d angle variables. At least you need another d quantities that vary in time. Now, we need an additional d variables. You could take, for example, the periodic spectra, and then you need an additional d variables. You could take the motion of m minus. That can be attained from this function m plus that I wrote down before. M plus and m minus evolve in time. And then these periodic and auxiliary spectrum also evolve. Now the periodic spectra, or the auxiliary spectrum, for d equals 2, there's only one of those, because the off-diagonal entries have a factor of lambda in there. So one of the zeros of those off-diagonal entries is zero. So that doesn't, it's always zero. That doesn't give us any information. So we want to look at the non-zero zeros of psi 1, 2, and psi 2, 1. So in this case, we get a lambda 2, 1 and a lambda 1, 2. These are the zeros, a lambda 2, j and a lambda 1, j. I'm sorry. I'm still doing the case of d particles. Okay. Anyway, you could eliminate a bunch of these things, but in fact, it's easy to use them all when you want to reconstruct the solution. Otherwise, you've got to do a lot of extra elimination, a lot of extra algebra. So these are not the action angle variables. This is more data than we need. But what we do need is the flows of the lambda 1 j's and the lambda 2 j's. And here are the differential equations you get for them. Q of lambda is this p squared of lambda minus 4, and then it's normalized. And so those give us the evolution of the lambda j's, and the m plus and m minus evolve according to these equations. So first you can solve these things, then you can determine m plus and m minus. You can get the evolution of those. So let's talk about the elliptic case d equals 2. When d is greater than 2, you're going to get your answers in terms of hyperelliptic Riemann theta functions. In the case d equals 2, this is the elliptic case. We can write everything down in terms of the Weierstrass elliptic function. Instead of using the lambda j's, I'm going to take their reciprocals. I'm going to take mu j equals 2 over lambda j. That simplifies the equation somewhat, but it still leaves them as equations on an elliptic curve, and you get these things in terms of the Weierstrass elliptic function. So these are the differential equations, and here are the solutions for mu1 and mu2, which are the reciprocals of the lambda j's. These are constants of, I said initial data, actually depends on the periods and so on and so forth. And then you can integrate the equations for m plus and m minus, and you get a nice, very nice formula in terms of the sigma function associated with the Weierstrass elliptic function. By a direct computation, you can write down p of lambda. It's not too hard in the case of two particles. So here it is. Since it's invariant, that tells you m, which is m1 plus m2 is invariant, and it gives you the second invariant. The second invariant is coefficient of lambda squared. All the coefficients of this polynomial p are invariants of the flow. And then you can invert these things, so you could write everything down in terms of these n1 and n2 are in terms of the masses m1 and m2 and the positions y1 and y2. And then you can invert these equations, and so you can express y1, y2, and m1 and m2 in terms of these quantities which you solve, the eigenvalues and so forth. So you can get explicit solutions. Now let's talk briefly about the Calandre-François flows. There's a change of the parameter here. We're going to put a nu squared. The formulas simply change. They're more or less the same, but you replace lambda by lambda over nu, and yj is now e to the 2 nu xj. And here's the fundamental solution of this thing. We're going to take beta minus minus beta plus equals 1. That's so that you've got a so that the strength of your fundamental singularity is one, so that you actually, so that your fundamental solution has the right weight or strength. And then you introduce this matrix psi of lambda is phi of lambda b. B is now the diagonal of beta minus and beta plus. So beta minus and beta plus are certain parameters in the problem, and this is really the only constraint on them. And then phi of lambda has more or less the same form. And now we're going to take psi of lambda to play the role of the, and I'll in quotes, the Floquet matrix, because we're not really talking about a periodic structure, but we are talking about the monodromy matrix of going across the layer. And it's going to be the spectrum of psi that we're interested in. The algebraic curves are the same. Yes? Well, it depends on... actually, Kamas at home, I think if you look at the original paper, I think they had 1/4. We changed it to 1. I mean, in a sense, it doesn't... I don't think... No, unless you take it... Well, if you scale it to 0, then you go to this Hunter-Saxon equation. But I don't think it makes a big difference. I think it just rescales the solutions, but it doesn't interfere with the integrability or anything. Okay, so we worked out a couple of explicit solutions, and you can analyze what happens. In the first case, if you take nu equal to 1, beta minus equals minus beta plus is 1/2, you get this growing exponential here. Then the solutions blow up in finite time, both for t greater than 0 and t minus 0, or t negative. In the second case, and I'm only taking the case where the m's have the same sign. I'm not looking at the case where the m's have different signs. In the second case, then you get periodic solutions. There's a similarity to the periodic Kamasa-Holm and the Calandra-Francoise flows. They look much the same. They actually coincide in certain cases. If I take nu greater than 0 and beta minus greater than 1, I can choose a period by x equals 1 over 2 nu log beta minus over beta plus. And then the Green's functions g sub nu x for the x-periodic Kamasa-Holm problem and the Green's function g of nu beta for the Calandra-Francoise flows are identical. So there is a certain region where the flows are identical, certain values of the parameters where the flows are identical. But the Calandra-Francoise flows are more general. So I think that's it. That's all I really wanted to say about this. So thank you very much.